Well, welcome back, everybody, to Take Me to Your Reader, discussing adapted science fiction at its best and worst. I'm Seth.
I'm James.
And I'm Colin.
And this time we are going to be talking about Roadside Picnic, 1972 book from the Strugatsky brothers, Boris and Arkady, I believe. And then we're going to talk about the 1979 Tarkovsky adaptation, Stalker. What's Tarkovsky's first name?
Andre.
That's right. I knew that. But, and speaking of which, well, not really, because nothing to do with Andre, but you might have heard the voice of someone who's joining us, who's previously joined us, Ben DiBono. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Seth. And guys, glad to be back.
Well, yeah. Thanks for coming. And I had reached out to Ben just a few days ago saying, hey, any way you could give us some tips on how to enjoy the movie Stalker, any because I know that it's one of your favorites, and so you're like, well, I could just come on the episode. So I like that you invited yourself on.
Always. I think that's a staple of what Matt and I do when we've been on podcasts. It's typically been a self-invite. So we're always happy to do that.
Yeah. It has been quite a few years since we had you on the podcast. I think it was 2016.
Ooh, too long.
So yeah. And I think in the interim, I actually came out to Minnesota and met Matt and Ben. So that was kind of fun.
Yes. Yeah. We played disc golf together.
Yes. This is what I do. This is how I engage with people.
Books and disc golf. There's worse ways to form friendships.
Yeah, exactly. Anything new with you or the Sci-Fi Christian since then?
Oh, gosh, I don't think so. I mean, I'm sure there's stuff new with me.
I'm sure you've got a bunch more kids.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, up to seven now. But Sci-Fi Christian keeps rolling on. We're up to about 1,200 episodes now, somewhere in there.
Wow. Now, before we started recording, I noticed in your background, maybe I should take a screenshot or something, or have you take a picture of the shelf and send it to me, where you have the entire Criterion collection behind you.
I do. Now, I'm missing the most recent handful of releases because they go on sale a few times a year. They're quite expensive. They're expensive even on sale. So I tend to wait till the sales come around and then buy them up. But yes, I do have the entire Criterion collection and I'm caught up. Minus, I think I still have a couple new releases here to watch. But beyond that, entirely caught up.
Nice.
And Stalker is in there, I think, 855.
Okay. And I will refer people over to, I think you did a Sci-Fi Christian episode about kind of finishing that.
Yep. We've done a couple episodes on it over the years. But yeah, the most recent one, I think, was last year. I finally caught up after about 8-9 years of watching through in order. So
all right.
It was one of those satisfying achievements, but also like, how have I been spending my life for the last decade?
Exactly. With seven kids.
Yes, with seven kids.
At some point, you had to find time to do something else.
Exactly.
And watch movies.
Yes.
Do you have to, though?
Right.
Do you have to start over once you hit the end? Start with number one?
No, I was going to say, we need to get like a full ranking, you know, one through whatever.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, on my Letterboxd, I definitely don't have a full ranking, but I have ranked decade by decade, meaning sets of 10 as I've gone. So okay. I've got a... probably about 120 lists or so of Criterion rankings at this point.
Nice. So with this one, I want to go around and talk first about like history with the material, starting with the book, because we usually start with the book. And so Ben, is this a book that you read prior to having seen the movie, or was it one you read in connection with the movie?
I read it after watching the movie. I'd seen Stalker, which I loved. And then I also saw, I don't know if you guys have seen or heard of Hard to Be a God. Mm-mm. Which is another, I'm going to get their names wrong. I'll let you do it, Seth. You pronounced it correctly. Brothers. Thank you. Another one of theirs. They actually have a series of interconnected futuristic, I think it's called The Noon Universe, and Hard to Be a God is one of that. And the film adaptation of Hard to Be a God, I'd seen as well, probably around the same time as Stalker. It's good. It's nowhere near as good as Stalker. And then shortly after that, I'd seen those two, Hunted Out, Roadside Picnic, read that, and then I re-read or re-listened to that this past week once we decided we were going to be doing this.
Nice. Okay, nice. Colin, previous history, you had read Roadside Picnic years ago, right?
Yeah, when we started doing podcasting, I started going on this wild reading spree, and our library has Roadside Picnic, and so I picked it up. And it was Russian.
Sure do.
It's not something you get to read every day.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you've talked about that on your podcast Science Fiction 101, which is another thing that's happened since we had Ben on. Yeah. Colin started another podcast. And,
oh, nice.
And you've talked about like trying to read more internationally because there's a bunch of stuff that just doesn't come to us originally in English, and so we tend to ignore it.
Yeah. Well, and the idea that, you know, we read science fiction because it's about aliens, and yet we don't even understand the science fiction of other cultures on our planet.
Yeah.
So why not start there?
Right, mm-hmm. Right.
How about you, James?
My previous experience was like about a month ago, and he told me I had to do this. So. Nice.
Old wily veteran.
Yeah, yeah. Pretty much what happens on these, Ben, is we'll throw out a title, and then basically we're waiting for James to say, hey, I read the book. And then we're like, oh, I guess we should get going on this.
Nice.
So yeah, this is one that was brand new for me as well, and I listened to the audiobook. Did you listen to the one read by Robert Forster?
Oh, gosh.
Ed the Disappearer from Breaking Bad?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
Wait, the book was read to you or the movie or both?
Both.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, talking specifically about the
was the book. I guess we'll get to the movie then. All right, okay. Yeah, I'm going to ask a question. Was the filming at OMSI the first time you seen it?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And so that's kind of, there's two reasons that we're doing this podcast. And one of them is it often happens that I'm covering something for my other podcast, and I'm like, hey guys, I'm going to be reading A Wrinkle in Time or whatever, you know, and so you guys want to cover that because it also happens to be adapted. And I'm planning to do an episode on science fiction in translation for my podcast.
Cool.
And this is one of the titles that was on the list along with really? Solaris. Okay. and a bunch of other stuff. And so who knows, we may get to that, because Ben, you had asked on the last time you were on, you're like, hey, if you ever get to Solaris, you know, reach out to me. But
yeah, that's like a decade long inviting myself.
It is. Yeah.
Examples.
Yeah. We haven't gotten to that, but we got you some Tarkovsky. So, so yeah, we'll talk about that. But I listened to the audiobook before you read it, I think, mm-hmm. James. And then once you said you read it, I'm like, right. Okay, when are we recording? Looking at the calendar. Yeah, I can give it a reread. So I actually picked up the ebook and kind of slowly read through it, just because I'd forgotten. I'd missed quite a bit of stuff in the audiobook. And so it was good to go back and refresh that. I will say that the lesson of the book apparently is a man can survive nearly any peril so long as he's got a flask with him.
I can attest to that.
because I mentioned to Colin how much drinking there is in it, and I read in the afterword that there were some objections from the Russian censors. Hey, yes. There's too much language and too much drinking. And I'm like, do you not know what Russians are to everybody in the popular culture? maybe they just don't want to perpetuate that. You know, they're all vodka drinking lushes or something. I don't know.
Well, and so what we're reading here in the States is not the original released book, right? This is the author's preferred restored version.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because
it was put into like a collection, I think, right? Yes. I can't remember what it was called. I don't know, Ben, maybe you know about that.
Yeah. I don't know the name of the, I don't recall it either, but I know they talk about that in the afterword.
Yeah. Yeah. And so Colin was like, hey, you've got the ebook, right? So search and find out how many occurrences are. There are 28 occurrences of the word flask. And this is like, you know, 180 page book.
Yeah. So
it's a pretty good reference. And drink comes up 58 times. So,
well, that makes that moment in Stalker, not to get ahead of ourselves, even better, where Stalker takes writer's bottle and just pours it out. It's like Andrei Tarkovsky, we're not doing that.
We're doing a dry movie here.
Exactly.
The saddest scene in the movie.
Nice. All right. So yeah, let's, does anybody want to tackle the, like what this book is?
You know, the movie and the book are so different. I think we have
right.
to.
Okay. So do you want to tackle it? You want me to do it?
You are much more brief than I am.
Okay, there we go.
You can do it.
All right. So the book in brief, the Roadside Picnic title, comes from the idea that aliens at some point visited Earth and just sort of randomly landed in a couple, in several places, six places. And I'm getting hand signals from Colin. And left behind stuff, and these areas became known as the zones, and there are these people called stalkers that go into these very dangerous areas and bring out artifacts, and essentially they make a living by selling them.
Contraband, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And the idea of the Roadside Picnic is that we don't really understand what the aliens were here for. We don't know if they even noticed that we were here. They might have viewed us as the bugs, you know, or the bugs and small animals coming back, gathering together in these areas after the landings, after we pulled over someplace and left a bunch of crap out there for them to find. So, yeah.
Yeah, the metaphor is contingent on littering. So very, very 1970s, 1960s.
Unfortunately, I do enough of, you know, spending time in parks and that kind of stuff. I know that it is still an issue.
Still there.
This is true.
Yeah. And I'm out there and I'm like, I mean, like, I just don't litter and I don't understand how people do. So anything else about the book?
I'd say there's a lot of Breaking Bad in this book.
Breaking Bad, okay.
Yeah, because we're not rooting for there is a main story, a protagonist. But he's not a great hero.
Sure.
He's a thief and a liar and a drinker and an adulterer.
Do we know that he's an adulterer?
We talked about this. You didn't hear that part.
But I reread the book, and it says that he slept with Dina, but we don't know what the timeline was.
Well, since Dina is younger than...
Right. You
know, Dina is older than his daughter, but she was created... by the golden orb.
And that's another question that I have, and I'm not sure the book totally answers it. So maybe we should talk about
that. I got the impression that they did.
Yeah.
And it was adultery, basically, at that point.
Okay. Colin mentioned the golden sphere, right? That is this legendary thing inside the zone where if you get to it, you can get your dearest wish of your heart. The movie goes...
So the movie does have an allegory. Analogy of that, so I guess it's worth mentioning.
Yeah, that's the goal of the whole movie, whereas the golden orb thing is chapter 5.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it motivates a lot of the latter parts of the book, because as he's you know, Burbage is basically saying, get me out of here and I'll get you a map to the orb or the sphere, right?
The sphere, yeah.
Oh, so let's talk about the book. Ben, how many times have you read this? Just a couple times?
Just twice, yeah.
Okay. What are your impressions of it?
You know, it's hard for me to separate it from Stalker because I'm such a fan of the movie. So I like the book. I want to read more by them. But to me, I can't help but compare it to the movie, which for me is in my top 10. Mm. And so the movie is like one of the most profound cinematic experiences I've had and have every time I watch it. And the book is good. You know, I enjoy it. So it always it's totally unfair. Totally unfair, especially since it came first. But it always just feels, both times I read it, kind of like, you know, standard sci-fi fare. I do think it's really interesting with the metaphor of the roadside picnic, how nihilistic that is on one level. Like, it's a deeply cynical metaphor. And if you're just reading the text of the book, the metaphor is just one interpretation among many. Yes. But by making it the title, there's a level of endorsement there that I'm not sure I love. I prefer when authors take a step back and allow for many interpretations. And I feel like an interpretation is kind of chosen for us through the title choice.
That gives me a clue as to why you prefer the movie then.
Yes. Well, you think there might be a little more open-ended nature to the film.
Yeah, just slightly, just barely.
Just slightly.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it starts off in sort of a almost didactic way where it, instead of an opening scroll, it has this interview with a professor talking about, you know, well, yeah, we know approximately where the aliens must have come from because we can see the pattern of landings across the globe, which I know it's going to really make the flat earthers mad.
This is true.
Yeah. Matt and Ben actually interviewed one of their listeners that's a flat earther a while back. That was kind of fun. And Ben was like, you know, I'm not going to challenge. I just want to hear it.
I mean, that's the most fun thing to do is you know, you can sit there and debate, but debates aren't terribly interesting to listen to. It's more interesting just to let people talk.
Mm-hmm. So the book is broken up into four parts where you have sort of Redrick Shewhart, mostly referred to as Red, who's a young stalker. He's only in his early 20s, I think. Mm-hmm. He goes through some pretty rough experiences. And then it jumps like 6 years, and then it jumps a few more years, and then Red's in prison, and it jumps a few more years till he's, I think, in his early 30s. Like we talked about, the kind of adaptation of Stalker is more from that fourth part than any of the rest of it. Colin, what did you think of the book? The first time you read it, you didn't really know what to make of it, right?
I didn't know what to make of it. The second time I read it, I definitely picked up on the whole anti-hero vibe.
Hmm.
And I have a feeling, you know, again, right? I'm reading something written in another language for another culture with a whole bunch of government censorship that was over it.
Yeah.
And so on the one hand, things were pulled out of it and put back in for the version we read.
Yeah.
On the other hand, there are things they didn't even try to put in there because they knew it wouldn't get past the censors at all.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So yeah, if you're looking for something like a positive story where you're rooting for the hero, this is not that kind of a story, right? There's you know, government corruption, crime corruption, people backstabbing and lying. There's a guy whose legs get dissolved.
Just the bones.
Only the bones.
Yeah. I will mention, too, that, like, this is a book that came out in Russia. It was originally in Russian, but it is not set in Russia. It's set in some country that has a royal army or royal air force or something. So Canada.
I was thinking Canada.
Australia.
Like Canada and close to the border of U.S. kind of thing.
Yeah, because there's some suspicion of Europe in there as well. So I didn't know if it was like England and therefore like England against everybody else in Europe. Mm. But I thought that was interesting because I just expected it to be set in Russia.
Right.
How about you, James? Oh, the other thing. I mean, we were going to talk about this, I'm sure, when we got to the movie. The other reason, I'm connecting something back to 10 minutes ago when I said there's a couple reasons why we do stuff sometimes. And one was that this had come up as something to read for my podcast. But also, we had the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry had their annual science fiction film festival, and they screened Stalker twice. And James was out of town, but Colin and I were there. And so we went and saw the movie. And so then, Colin, the context for your reread of this was after seeing the movie.
Yes.
Yeah. And
it was packed both times,
It was sold out both times.
300, yeah, awesome. 300 plus.
Man, I would love to see Stalker projected. That would be phenomenal.
It's on a great screen, too. So just come out here next summer. I'm sure they'll screen it.
Okay.
Hey, there's marathons out this way, too.
So. Yeah. Nice.
The marathon's huge.
Yeah, but it's in the fall. So.
Oh, well, that's a good point.
Yeah. So the film festival ran 8 weeks. They screened 41 different movies. Stalker keeps coming back. So if it shows up, I'll try and drop you a line online so you can decide if you want to come out.
Yeah.
Nice.
And Colin and Phil did a great interview with the guy who curated the film festival. And he put in there, he's nice enough to me. I told him, hey, tell the guy that I want to see Sunshine on the big screen because it wasn't there. And so they did talk about some of the hurdles to getting to working with the studios and getting the movie in the correct format. So yeah, that was cool. That's another reason why we're doing this is just because we were able to go see it on a big screen. So that was the way we talked. We saw it, and we'll talk about that when we get back to it. But James, what did you think of that?
So my assessment.
The book.
The book. Yeah. Right. First of all, I thought it was a quick read that went by. I like how they separated up into the different zones.
Parts. Yeah.
Parts. Yeah. I like the interview kind of introduction to the whole book. But I think by the time I got to the end, first of all, the end was like kind of left me hanging. I was like, I wasn't a huge fan of the end of the book. Mm. But when they had the whole soliloquy with the metaphor of the roadside picnic, I absolutely love that metaphor, by the way.
Yeah,
I think it's a great way to put a picture, to wrap a picture or frame the visit, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And after a thought of it for a while, it feels like this book was could be a short story just with that little bit of what exactly was this alien visit, and then expand, and it felt like it could have been expanded about that with all the other different chapters they threw around it. Because the book doesn't really make a whole lot. It didn't really make a whole lot of sense to me until I read the entire thing. I think I want to say, and there's no, except for the common thread of the stalker and its perpetual motivation to just get artifacts, I guess. That was probably the single thread that ties them all together, right?
Yeah.
Up until even the golden sphere at the end. But they're always going into the zone for more stuff to bring out and sell, and then talking about how the market and the environment around that, I suppose.
Right. Because
you got
right.
the science part of it, the industry part of it, business, government, you name it.
Yeah, the military. And military too, right? Yeah. And I like the idea of like, you're going in there and pulling out artifacts. You have no idea what they are or how dangerous they are.
Right.
And yet you're bringing them out. And then we may not be using them for the purpose of
even for which the intended, they're intended purpose, right?
At all. Right.
Yeah.
But we have no frame of reference for their intended purpose even is the point. Right.
Yeah.
And so I liked the book as an exploration of what do you do with this stuff with an alien visit that just came and went. You never even got to say hi to the people. It doesn't even count as contact, I think, because they just came and went. And then what do you do after that? Because I think this book could have been written a dozen different ways if you wanted to routes to take it. So I appreciated it for what it was.
Yeah, and that's a good point on the first contact, because first contact is such a common trope in sci-fi. Mm-hmm. And typically it's either invasion or some type of hostility,
right?
Or it's the benevolence. You know, yeah. We come in peace, and maybe that erupts into hostility, or maybe it's ET or whatever. This is kind of unique within that subgenre, I think. I don't know of another one where it's just like we're on such different planes of existence. It's ships passing in the night.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's more like, the Tar Aim Krang from Alan Dean Foster instead of District 9 or V or any of those alien contacts.
Yeah, yeah. Childhood's End.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. So the book kind of goes through these different phases where, like, at the beginning, you get the impression that he's gotten into some trouble in the past, but he's on the straight and narrow right now, working for the Institute, looking for a legitimate reason to go into the zone.
Yeah.
And that's where he has the disastrous one with Burbage, where he loses the bones in his legs because of the hell slime, which I hadn't really caught the time before that was what was in the container that he brought out with him and that he didn't want to give to the, what were their names? Raspy and I can't remember what their names were.
Oh, the mafia people.
Yeah.
Well, the military guys, right? The KGB guys or whatever. They wanted to make a weapon of mass destruction, and it ended up killing a bunch of people, right?
Mm-hmm. Destroyed their lab.
Because when he realized that he was under arrest in that third part or whatever it was, when he knew he was going to go inside, he said, "All right, I'll tell you where the stuff is. Just take care of my wife."
Yeah.
And so that was interesting, and they used it. And then I like that in that chapter, talking about the roadside picnic, talking about how, we don't know what we're doing here. Mm-hmm. And, look at that incident that happened where they brought back this hell slime and it blew up and killed 30 people. It's the kind of thing that would happen.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Well, and the funny thing is the person he asked to take care of his wife was the person who was selling out the other stalkers to the government.
Yeah.
And so, that's how they kept a tab on everything that was going on.
Yeah. So like for me, I mentioned I listened to the book, the audiobook, and then I read it after seeing the movie. And I do feel like after seeing the movie, like the vibe of the movie got into my second reading of the book, and I really did enjoy it. And I even like the way it ends, just because I feel that's sort of faithful to the way the movie ends in a lot of ways, where it kind of leaves you hanging a little bit. Or it doesn't show how do you get back out of the zone, right? The book yada yada's every bit about going into the zone and coming out of it. It's just, and now we're in the zone again. And now we're back out of the zone. And I kind of dug that it didn't want to go into the ins and the outs of that. And so it in terms of something that you're going to have for an adaptation, it's ripe for showing like, what is the area to get into the zone like?
And by leaving it open.
Yeah.
Well, Tarkovsky does not yada yada getting into the zone.
No, not at all.
Nope.
No. Yeah. And like on that first, I guess the first trip in is the one where Kirill backs into like the silver filament that ends up killing him.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I like this quote. There's somebody named Austin and he said, "Austin isn't a bad guy. He's got the right mix of courage and cowardice, but I think he's already doomed. You can't explain this to Kirill, but I know these things. The man has decided he's got the zone completely figured out, and so he'll soon screw up and kick the bucket." And like that's the thing about like talking about how dangerous the zone is.
Well, the fact that you have to walk around the zone looking for microgravity concentrations that would whiz you up like a helicopter.
Yep. Yeah, or squish you flat like that bird that he comes across that's completely flattened, like two-dimensional. And there's another guy who's sort of like an anti-stalker where he's like, "I'm going to find any artifacts that I can of the zone and put them back into the zone because I feel like this is Pandora's box or it's the devil's playground." And
which does seem crazy to me given the fact how dangerous to even go in there and traverse and then come back out.
Mm-hmm. I even like some of the wording, like coming back with a full empty.
Yes.
It reminds me of 1984, right? Where war is peace, freedom is slavery. Like it's doublespeak.
Well, and that's how he gets Kirill to go in with him.
Mm-hmm.
How would you like to see a full? And it takes Kirill a second to realize, is it what you're talking about? There's stuff that goes in here?
Yeah. Yeah. Other discussion, the monkey. We should talk about the monkey.
Yeah.
In the book or in the movie?
Not sure.
Book. Yeah, so one of the side effects of going into the zone is that you can have mutant children. And so both of Burbage's known born children are mutants. And that's kind of how we get to meet Red's wife, Guta, right? She's in love with him. Mm-hmm. And at the end of, I think it's chapter one, where problems are starting to happen, she says, I'm pregnant. My mom says I should leave you and they'll help me take care of the baby. But, you know, I want to be with you. And so now Red is kind of stuck in this life of being a stalker. He couldn't go legit and just only work for the lab because you can't make a lifestyle living off that. Mm. So now he has to do this. And his daughter is covered all with golden fur.
I like the way it says she's completely normal, other than the fact that she's covered with golden fur and has black eyes.
Yeah.
But, you know, as the book progresses, too, it starts talking about how she's starting to not be able to speak anymore. And so it's like she's becoming feral almost.
Yeah.
Devolving. Right?
Yeah.
And see, that's what makes me think that so Burbage had two mutant children and two other children that are completely normal. And one of them goes off to be a lawyer and the other one is Dina.
Right.
Right. And so Burbage gives him the other child, and that child, that's Arthur.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Arthur is supposed to go with Red in the last chapter into the zone to learn how to be a stalker.
Right.
But he's really there to be a sacrifice.
Right.
Because you can't get to the golden orb unless you distract the meat grinder with someone else's body.
Yeah.
And then he can sneak past it.
Now, was it explicit that Burbage knew and that Red knew that the other guy, Arthur, was going to die or needed to die in order for Red to get to the golden sphere?
I don't know if it was.
I thought it was implied.
I don't know that Burbage knew, but I interpret it as fairly certain that Red knew.
Yeah, I remember Red kind of thinking, you know, do you know what you've done here in sending your son with me? That do you right. know what That's, I have to do?
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
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 Yeah. Yeah. Well, and then when they find the other leftovers from the meat grinder in previous, it talks about, you know, Burbage making Arthur and Dina in that context.
Mm-hmm.
So, right. Yeah, Burbage definitely knew.
So, Ben, you were going to say something. I can't remember in connection to what.
Oh, it's just an interesting connection that you mentioned Monkey doesn't speak or can't speak in the book or losing her ability, and that's she's completely silent in the film. So that's kind of an interesting adaptation point I hadn't noticed before.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. The Wikipedia article has a quote from an interview done with Tarkovsky, and it goes, the script of Stalker has nothing to do with the novel Picnic on the Roadside, except for the two words Stalker and Zone. So you see, the history of my film is really deceptive.
Sure. Sure.
And yet we're finding all these other points of alignment, like, you know, Monkey mm-hmm. being quiet and, you know, she was in a golden scarf, which is kind of a nod back.
Yes.
There. Yeah.
Right.
That's a common Tarkovskyism in interviews, though. He's got a strong, grumpy old man streak in him, and I don't think he enjoyed giving interviews. And so he'd make these big, brash statements, and then you'd watch his movies. I don't know if that's the case.
Oh, funny.
Well, you're certainly more familiar with his work than we are. So yeah, the Dina and his other kid, like when Red is hauling Burbage out, and Burbage is promising him, and, hey, if you get me out of here, I'll get you a map to the Golden Sphere. Is he implying that he got to the Golden Sphere, wished for perfect children,
mm-hmm.
and then that got him out, and then he got out, and so Dina did not exist prior to that?
That's my understanding.
Okay.
Now, granted, it is not spelled out that explicitly.
Yeah.
But when you compare it, like I said, he's got two good ones and two bad ones, and right. he's been in there.
Yeah. But at some point, Red is kind of thinking back to him, to hooking up with Dina and talking about how disappointing it was. And I thought that's interesting. You know, she's supposedly this perfect woman or something, but
not completely perfect.
Yeah. Yeah.
She only looks perfect. She isn't not.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
It's interesting with the children, you know, this theme that comes up of the children having mutations or whatever for both the film and the novel, how much they prefigure Chernobyl, you know, and the idea of like, radioactive mutations and everything. Mm. Like, they're both eerily prophetic.
Yeah, that is kind of crazy, actually. I like the way the book is written. There's some descriptions. And, I have to admit, Colin, when you talked about the anti-hero thing and, like, you didn't like Red, I really kind of enjoyed him. And I mean, he was definitely, you know, not the nicest person, right? Because there's some point where he gets on an elevator and he with and before he can, the doors can shut, people get on, and he just hates them. And it just talks of, it just describes in great detail, what he thinks of them. And I was like, yeah, I felt that way on an elevator before.
I was going to say, in fairness to Red, have you ever been on an elevator full of people?
Yeah. And the one guy who feels like he has to say something to you, and I want to say back to him,
it's like,
you
know, shut up.
Yeah.
This is a 30-second relationship.
Exactly. The fact that we are here together is not a valid pretext for a conversation.
Yes.
Yeah. But that's just because I'm a bit of a misanthrope sometimes, and I know you are, Ben.
Yes, yes.
Another random thing from the book is the reanimated corpses that just because why?
Why not?
Yeah. and not a typical zombie thing, right? Like Red's dad just comes home and is evidently a perfectly nice zombie. So.
Yeah, but definitely not human.
Yeah, yeah. So that was a little, and you know, they talk about the, like, if you cut off the leg of one of the reanimated corpses, it will continue twitching. Or they talk about they cut off a hand and it kept flipping them off.
Yes.
Which I thought was amazing.
Yeah, there were some very funny parts of the book, and I think that was one of them. Also, a lot of Red's commentary about his coworkers, the people he's selling to, kind of even what he does as a stalker.
Yeah.
Right.
So if there's kind of an action part of the book, it's definitely in part four where Red and Arthur are trying to get to the Golden Sphere, and they about get cooked by the steam trap and then the lightning traps and the slime that they have to trudge through, which I thought was an amazing description where he's like 100,000 rotten eggs on top of 100,000 fish heads and dead cats couldn't have smelled this bad. but yeah, they get through there, and then Arthur kind of freaks out when he realizes he sees the sphere, and he gets up and runs down there and is talking about what he's going to wish for, right? Happiness for everyone. And I think it's interesting, and the movie definitely picks more up on this. Like, if something is going to give you your fondest wish, how well do you know yourself to know what your fondest wish actually is? And I love the fact that, like, to me, the conclusion that I, made where Red finds himself completely flummoxed and doesn't know what he could possibly ask for.
He wants to wish for the monkey to be normal. That's the whole drive. You know, to me, there's this arc of the story, which is, you know, Red as the confident, brash stalker, mm-hmm. Red as the stalker who does what he does in order to survive. And then at the end of it, after the prison sentence, after his daughter begins to become unhuman, so mm-hmm. unhuman that she can't be reached, mm-hmm. he's finally willing to listen to Burbridge, who owes him that debt from years ago when he saved him and drug him out when his legs were being dissolved. Mm-hmm. He's finally willing to give him the way to the orb and give him one of his kids to sacrifice because he wants to go in and save her. Mm. But when he gets there, yeah, he sacrifices Arthur and he's like, now I can't decide.
Right, right. And to me, it, and Ben, we'll talk about this, I'm sure, like the encounter with the transcendent in some way. And it reminded me of the end of Job, where God appears in the whirlwind and, you know, gives everybody what for a bit. And then is basically, all right, Job, what you got? Yeah. And Job's like, nothing. I got nothing to say.
Yep.
And that's what that moment reminded me of, was that he was just kind of overawed and like, well, if you know everything, you know what I should wish for. And it's a profound theological question too, right? Like what is the need for prayer, right? If God knows what we need, why do we have to ask for it? And this is the kind of stuff that's talked about in theology. Any other thoughts about the book, James?
Nope, I don't think so.
Well, I like that it's vague at the end though, because even though it ends with him saying, well, I'm going to choose what Arthur does, you don't know if it actually happens or not.
Yeah. Yeah, right. That's the thing I like about it as well.
Yeah, there's a Stephen King short story where there's a scientist that wants to, again, you know, cure all violence in the world, and they find this compound which will do it, and so he dumps it into a volcano to spread it all over the earth, and then understands that what he's really done is he's given every single thing on the earth massive dementia.
Oh,
and it's told first person, so you know he's going through this whole process, and then as he writes, as to describe what's happening, his writing becomes more juvenile and simplified, and finally, it's like pencil writing with shaky fingers, and
oh, that's funny.
That's the end of the book.
Oh, dang. Fun.
So you know we know what he wanted to ask.
Yeah, but
we don't know what happens or what the consequences are.
Right, and that's the movie definitely talks about that as well. Like, what should humans have access to the room? And it reminds me of Serenity. Right, where they find out that the, what are they called? Reavers?
Yeah.
Were invented because they tried to pacify
right.
the the populace by trying to make people better. They ended up basically killing off most of them because they just like they were so passive that they just died at their desks, mm-hmm. And starved, and that there was the reverse that happened to some people as well. But yeah, I like that idea of to what length do we go to pacify people, to make people happy, right? There are some people who are only going to be happy because other people are being exploited or abused.
Right.
And you can't make them happy. Right. Anything else for the book, or should we move on to the movie?
Well, we got Ben here to talk about the movie. Yeah, so. Exactly.
Yeah, Tarkovsky time. Bring us I'm here.
Yeah, yeah. So, okay. So I want to go around and talk about everybody's first encounter with the movie. For three of us, that's pretty recent. Mm-hmm. And so Ben, I'm going to save you for last. Okay.
Perfect.
So Colin and I saw it with Colin's son, Tim, at OMSI on this massive screen. I think it's one of the largest screens in Oregon, isn't it?
Yeah.
And we walked out of there kind of going, of all the movies we've ever watched, that was definitely one of them. and you know, a bit confused. Now, I have to admit that like I think I'm more comfortable with you are than you are, Colin, with watching something that just brings up questions. And like the questions will sit with me and they'll bore into my brain, and I like that. I also like being just entertained in a movie. And Stalker is not, I don't think, a movie that's intended, you know, the same way, for instance, MCU movies would be. You and Ben, right. Or you and Matt have talked about this many times, right? The value of art to your films. But
yes.
But yeah, I have to admit, I didn't get all of it. And reading the book and then watching the movie again, I think did help somewhat. But Ben, maybe you could dispute whether that's a good thing or not. But what about you, Colin?
Yeah, so, you know, I've been pretty outspoken in the past on this podcast about, you know, artier films and the things I like and the things I don't like. And it was pointed out to me by my son, Peter, yesterday. He said, you know, Dad, I've been listening to your old podcast. And when you came across something you didn't like, you used to say, this sucks. I don't want to talk about it. And, you know, over 10 years, I think I've been, you know, maturing, beaten down, changed, grown up enough, something like that, to where I can then say, you know, this movie really wasn't for me, but there are things we can talk about, you know, where I saw this or didn't see that, or I wonder about this. And
well, I noticed that with you even talking, because you and Tim went to 20 films or more, right?
Yeah.
And some of the movies you went to Blade Runner and Blade Runner 2049, and those are not movies you raved about the first time. And yeah. I felt like you talked about them in more positive terms on a rewatch.
Yeah. Well, so we decided, right? We're not going to For a lot of these recordings, we watch the movie or one of the movies together, and then we turn around and podcast.
Yeah.
And I need time to marinate in a movie.
Yeah.
To try and, you know, figure out my thoughts and, you know, put aside the
yeah, you need time to process, right?
Yeah, the gut reactions and be more cerebral to think about it rather than just react to it.
Yeah. Speaking of gut reactions, James just watched the movie for the first time.
Oh, my. So. And can I ask, is this your first Tarkovsky
yes.
for all of you guys?
Yes. Yeah. Wait, okay. You haven't seen Solaris?
No.
Okay.
Neither.
All right. Yeah. First Tarkovsky for all of us. So we'll get back to that, Ben. Oh, so yep. James, what did you think? I will say, let me I'm going to let you speak. I'm going to Kanye West this for a minute here.
I'm going to tell you what you're going to say, but then I'm going to let you speak.
James at some point was like movie's just about done, right? And I'm like, James, there is an hour and a half left in this
movie. No, part one is done. Part one is.
Yeah, pretty much. So, all right, go ahead, James.
Oh, where to start? Gosh. What did I think of the movie? It was slow, and I'm easily distracted. Yeah. Let's start with that. I didn't really get what was going on in the beginning when they were just like doing seemingly random stuff. I'm like, okay.
Oh, driving around in random directions before they got to the zone?
No. This was the scene when they're in the – it looked like they were in the bar, I think.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
That's how you get to meet all the characters.
Yeah. So, okay, that's interesting.
I mean, that's the easiest scene. They're being Russians. They're in the bar.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're what, alcohol's bad for you? Okay, then we'll have beer.
Deal.
Breakfast of champions.
But I think a lot of the movie was probably lost on me because, A, I'm terrible at reading subtitles because I get distracted by the film itself. And then I don't have the background that all you guys do with the mysticism and the biblical references and all that stuff. Because I know you were pointing out to me, is there coming in.
Oh yeah, I was like, oh, that's a reference really? From, okay. from, I don't know from Daniel. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, believe it or not, I had no idea.
Most of those went over my head too.
Yeah.
And so, you know, even though I read the Bible pretty regularly and know some other things, mm-hmm. right over the top of my head.
Yeah. But I do like, so the more I did like how they got into the, like when they got into the zone, that was cool to see, like tricking the train and all that jazz. And I did appreciate the kind of summary you sent us, Ben, with the like how to watch a Tchaikovsky film. So that that helped.
Good.
And actually good. Kind of rounded some stuff out for me. And I did like the more like theological, philosophical discussions, like you were saying, like what's the point of praying, or what's the point of the room in general? Do we need to destroy this? Should humans have it? It was interesting conversations to have in the same vein of that type of conversations I had with the book.
Yeah.
So the parallels there, despite you know what Colin was saying about the interview where he's like, nope, this ain't based on the book. It's like, okay. I was a little disappointed it didn't turn out to be like an alien movie. Aliens would have been kind of cool with all the weird stuff.
Okay. So the reason that James is disappointed is because he played the video game before watching the movie.
Yes. Through reading the book, the edition of the book I have has a big advertisement on it for the movie and the video game. And so I was like, what? This is a video game? And so I looked, I'm like, sure is. I bought it on PlayStation. I've been playing it for the last like week or so. And it's been pretty fun. it's more.
I have not played the game, but I would love to.
And it's more like the film, I think, than the movie. Or, sorry, the film than the book. There isn't aliens in the game either. It's a happens after like basically a second Chernobyl incident that creates the zone. And there's like, it's pretty post-apocalyptic. You know, there's bandits and the army again is trying to maintain order. And then you got the stalkers that go in and get the artifacts and there's mutants everywhere and radiation zones and et cetera. Yeah. It's been a pretty fun game though. It's kind of like plays a lot like Half-Life, first person kind of shooter game.
Well, no, you just sold it.
That's not bad.
Half-Life plus Tarkovsky, I'm there.
Yeah. And it starts off with, I think, a pretty decent story, too. So,
sorry, are you still reeling from the WTF-ness of the movie?
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay. Nice. Okay, so let's turn it over to Ben here for a little while to talk about Tarkovsky and, like, you know, some of your thoughts about why this movie means so much to you.
Sure. So two things I want to follow up from what James said first. You were mentioning quotations from the Bible, and you didn't recognize a lot of them. Well, not all of them are the Bible. He also is quoting at various points, I'm going to pronounce this wrong, the I Ching, as well as Tarkovsky often puts in his father's poetry. His father was a poet. Mm. So, you know, talk about obscure for things that you're not going to be familiar. Like, where is that in the Bible? It's not. It's the Book of Tarkovsky. and then the other thing is you're mentioning, you know, being disappointed about some of the sci-fi elements that aren't there, especially compared to the book. Interesting behind the scenes, this Stalker had a very troubled production.
Yeah.
It was basically reshot three mm-hmm. times. The script is being rewritten, and Tarkovsky was wanting to go further and further away from the book. And he eventually wore the Strugatsky brothers down, and they suggested, out of frustration, why don't we just take the sci-fi elements out? And he said, well, it's your idea. Okay, I guess I agree.
Inception.
Yes. So, yeah, that's where he could be, not, you know, fascinating visionary, but doesn't seem like the easiest person to work with in the world. So I first encountered Tarkovsky actually watching through Criterion. I mentioned I was watching through them in order. And the first one in the collection from him is Andrei Rublev, which is in the 60s, so relatively early on. And that movie, like a lot of stuff I was watching as I started watching through Criterion, just changed my conception of what movies can be. Similar vein to what you just experienced, where very contemplative, very thought-provoking. That one's about the Orthodox icon painter. He's a historical figure, Andrei Rublev. And really just open my mind up to the way that a film can take all the different elements you're used to in any type of movie and make a truly transcendent experience in a way I hadn't experienced before. From there, I subsequently watched all of Tarkovsky's work, which isn't, you know, a huge undertaking. He only made 7 features.
Because this movie killed him.
This movie did kill him, yes.
Oh, that happened years later. Yeah.
No, but there's an interesting behind-the-scenes note on that, that one of the people who worked on the film actually believes this movie literally killed him. There was a pipe that was dumping chemicals or whatever into the water that they're all standing in. Whether or not it's true or not, but this person, whoever it was, who was, I think she was a sound engineer, believed that was a contributing factor to him getting cancer. He only made two more films after this and died after the release of Sacrifice in 1985. So didn't live too terribly much longer after this. But Tarkovsky to me is, Kubrick's my favorite. I love Kubrick. But Tarkovsky's probably number two for me. Andrei Rublev is my favorite of what he's done, but Stalker is right up there. There's a handful that I absolutely love. This movie in particular, I when you guys talked about it being slow, I 100% get that. And there are great movies that I love that I experience as being slow. This is not one of them. And it's hard to explain why. I find myself just instantly absorbed in it when I start watching it, in a way that the only thing that I find comparable to that is some of Terrence Malick's work. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Malick, Tree of Life, Thin Red Line, Days of Heaven. And that's not well, you guys screwed up watching it. You think it's slow. It's like, no, I totally get, like, this is a slow movie. It is objectively a slow movie, but my subjective experience of watching it is not that. Even like the train scene and everything. I think that there's a feature of slow cinema where it almost becomes hypnotic when you get into these long shots, like they're on the rail car and everything. And you're going to have one of two reactions, I think. It's either, okay, are we done? Nope, we're not done. Are they there yet? Mm-hmm. Or you just kind of accept it and you enter into it and you're right there with it. And you sort of disappear into the experience. And that's what I find with Tarkovsky. You mentioned like getting it figured out. There's things about this movie that I can explain where I think he's doing this and this is happening on a plot point and this is that. But one of the things I love about this film is, even rewatching it a couple nights ago, there's stuff that I've never considered before. And I've seen it half dozen times or so. And is still occurring to me. And that's a mark of the great movies. I've seen 2001, which is my favorite movie, probably a dozen or so times. And every time I watch it, I see new things in it. You know, in the case of Stalker, to give an example this time around, one of the things that really stood out to me was the influence of Dostoevsky's Brothers Karamazov on there, with the three men being the three brothers. You know, if you've read any Dostoevsky, he's very famous for the concept of the holy fool, who is an idiot, who is an instrument of God, you know, hence the book, The Idiot, as being the most explicit reference to that in his work. And that very much corresponds to Stalker. The two other brothers, Ivan and Dmitry in Brothers Karamazov, represent the intellectual and the sensual person. And so there you have writer as the sensual, you know, just trying to soak everything out of life, hedonistic, and professor as the intellectual. But to me, like, there's certain movies, and it's not just because this has religious connotations to it, but there are certain movies that almost become spiritual experiences for me. Blade Runner 2049, which is not a particularly religious movie, I had that very similar experience watching that, at least for the first time in IMAX, where I just felt overwhelmed and felt like, you know, you're watching something that goes beyond the normal level of art. Again, Terrence Malick does that for me, especially Tree of Life. I think is an incredibly profound film. And Stalker is one of the handful of movies that I can put on anytime, and it's going to evoke that inside of me. It takes me to a place that, and I'm Catholic, so only like the most holy Easter liturgy or Good Friday liturgy, you know, those deep, deep, profound liturgies do, and makes you contemplate a deeper dimension that goes beyond the art. So I'm aware I'm not talking a lot about the movie. I'm talking more about like the experience I have of watching the movie, but and it's not my implication that this is what you should get out of the movie or you haven't gotten it. But this is what I see there, and this is why it means what it does to me.
Yeah.
I think that may explain why now, almost you know, 50 years later, people still watch this movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. So I was such a fan of the Science Fiction Film Festival. We went to as many movies as we could. And then I built a spreadsheet where I tracked the decade all the movies came from. And then I did that for every other year that they did this. They just keep bringing Stalker back. And on the podcast that I did with Phil, Russ, who was the vice president at Elmsy, who was in charge of the film festival, said, yeah, you know, it's a classic and everybody loves it.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are movies you watch once and go, wow, that was so much fun, but you never watch it again. And there are movies that you just keep coming back to. Mm-hmm. And for every person, those movies are different. My wife will watch The Sound of Music or Frozen or other kinds of things over and over. I read The Martian yearly. And you know, Ben, you would sit down and watch Stalker just whenever you had the feeling, because that's the thing that you like to do. And it brings such meaning to you, and you enjoy the analysis and the detail and the experience of it.
Yeah.
So.
Right, right.
One of the things that I picked up on this time, on the second watch, was I noticed early in the movie, Stalker, there are no names. Stalker says, when his wife is objecting to him going back in the zone, she says, you'll be put back in prison. And he basically says, I'm in prison everywhere else. And so it's like the fences are keeping him in the real world, or, you know, in the fake world, right? In the sepia toned world. And the zone is where the real world is. It reminded me of Aslan's country from the Chronicles of Narnia.
Yeah.
Like it's more real, somehow. And it seems
it's a reverse gulag.
Yeah. Yeah. Know, exactly. That's a great term for it.
Yeah. But then for the daughter, is she an element of life that's outside of that? Or because she's, you know, of the zone, so to say, does she experience that everywhere?
Right. And she kind of brings it with her, right? Because every scene that shows her
That was interesting.
Is in color. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That
shows her primarily, right?
Yeah.
That's really interesting. And Ben, I noticed that I looked at your Letterboxd review just before we got on and saw that reverse gulag thing that you had mentioned. And I was like, yes, I caught that this time. So I was like, yes, I'm so proud of myself.
Yeah, that's the great thing. It's like, I didn't notice that either until this time, which I'm kicking myself for because it feels like an obvious one once it's pointed out, especially since this was his final film he made in Russia. His last two were made in Italy and Sweden, respectively, because he just got fed up with the censors. And I've always wondered, what was it about Stalker that, you know, made them so angry? Because the religious elements are much more profound in something like Andrei Rublev than they are even here. I think it's probably that. Like, this is a, you know, the Soviet state is the gulag.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if there were things he was forced to put into the movie that he necessarily didn't want. Like, you know, in certain ways, the Stalker is an outlaw. He's going into the zone without permission. But while in the zone, he is, you know, the leader for that little group, and he's their hope of getting to the room safely. And there are several discussions about, you know, the failure of the creatives and the failure of the scientists. And it's really the common man who's leading you around, who is the hope. And that to me talks about, you know, the communistic society. And
So I think the challenge with that interpretation, and I want to be really careful because a film like this, I don't want to poo-poo any interpretation, but to maybe give just a counterpoint to it, is that I think Stalker as the leader has to be put in the context of the Emmaus Road scene, you know, where he quotes the story of the Emmaus Road, which is a really, really interesting sequence because you have these weapons and this freaky large syringe. Like, holy crap, what was that thing being used? That's like a Pulp Fiction syringe, you know, that are under the water. And then we get this long tracking shot when they're having the slumber party. It starts with the gun and the syringe. It goes forward. We get an icon of John the Baptist, who in Christianity paves the way for the coming of the Lord. And then we get to Stalker finally, who then reads off the Emmaus Road scene. And he's definitely in the person of Christ there, which is a concept in both Catholicism and Orthodoxy of the priest is in persona Christi when he's performing the sacraments. He is the person of Christ. That's where I see Stalker as less as the common man, again, not wanting to poo-poo any interpretation of a film that invites a variety of interpretations, but as a almost Christ-like holy fool figure at that point, leading them to the Holy of Holies in the room.
Right.
Oh, so speaking ignorantly about someone that doesn't watch a lot of Russian film or read a lot of Russian books, unfortunately, my understanding was that religion was supposed to be, you know, tamped down and censored. So to have that much of a forward religious element in the film that was paid for by the state.
It's shocking, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. What Tarkovsky got away with in his career is shocking. Like, it boggles the mind.
Interesting. Yeah.
Especially when you consider Andrei Rublev, which again is his most religious work. It is about a Orthodox icon painter. What's his second film? And I think it's probably because, you know, even within the communistic system, you had this, you could suppress it, but you couldn't. You still had this kind of folk hero aspect to it. Right. And Andrei Rublev, not a household name in the West, but in the East, would be much, that'd be more like the equivalent of St. Francis of Assisi or something like that. Somebody that you'd at least be familiar with by name.
Interesting. I definitely want to talk about the encounter with the room. And, you know, it's funny. I was trying to think of another comparison. It escapes me at the moment, but like where you have something that leads up to a moment and then they don't do it. Right. Where they go through all this trouble and all the difficulty of getting through that tunnel and the room with the dunes in it.
Yeah. Isn't the dune room great, by the way? Like, I just love the way that room looks. I don't know.
Oh yeah.
Why?
It looks fantastic. Yes. And like when I saw the cover for the movie and the cover for the book that James was reading, it's that picture, right? That's usually what you see. Yep. And like, it looks like much more of a science fiction thing, right? You look like this is on some alien world. Like, no, it's just in the zone.
And that's where we get the disappearing bird too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It reminds me of the final set of scenes from Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah, yeah. Mm.
Everyone is, you know, trying to find the Ark because of all of its meaning, and they finally get it, and they have this big ceremony, and instead of witnessing what's going to go on, Indy knows that is not the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And so, you know, he says, look away, and they look away, and everyone else gets destroyed by the holy angels. And,
Yes.
Right. Yeah, and I going back to what you said, Ben, about the brothers Karamazov and the writer being the kind of sensuality point of view, right?
Yes.
And yet he gets to the room and he's like, no, I'm not going in. I don't want to subject the world to essentially my depraved desire, right? Because like he knows himself well enough to know that nothing good can really come, and nothing good for the world can come from him getting his dearest wish.
Yeah. And I love that the room, and I think this is true in the book too, though maybe slightly less explicit. I love that it's not a genie. I love that it's not you go in and make a wish. Right. Yeah. You go in and you get whatever is inside of you.
Yeah.
And you might not know what that is.
Right. Yeah. And so I you know, I'm not Catholic, but you know, I'm familiar enough with Catholicism and from listening to you over the years as well. I feel like when they're standing out there, it's like they're doing an examination of conscience before going into the confessional and realizing, whoop, yeah, I'm not sure I can subject the priest to that.
Yeah. Now there is one character who does go into the room, and
the camera goes in, right? Yeah.
The camera goes in. Yeah. And it's worth noting too, when I talk about the camera as a character, that might seem a little cute until you, if you go back and watch the film, which I'm sure is right at the top of all of your to-do list after you know, just 3 hours of Tarkovsky this afternoon.
Yeah.
There's a lot of shots like where he'll throw the nut with the washer or the bandage attached to it.
Yeah.
And then he'll send them off. The camera actually follows first. The camera enters the shot, and then the other characters follow in. Like, we are constantly doing the same journey with them along the way. And I'm fascinated by the fact that Tarkovsky doesn't give us a choice. Like, he forces us into the room. And it should be a moment then that makes us subjectively ask ourselves, okay, I'm in here. Obviously, it's a movie. This isn't reality, but it should make you wonder. Like, it should really drive that point home for you.
Yeah, and that was one of the things that taking out of the movie the first time that I thought about for weeks, where I was like, yeah, I don't know. Like, if somebody told me I can tell you what the inmost desire of your heart is, I'm not sure I would want to know. Because it's one of those know yourself kind of things, right? Where you know, I understand what kind of a person I am, and I try to be different than what's deep down.
Exactly. Like what there's that war, and it was very true to Christianity of all flavors, and even, you know, non-Christian thought of, there's different, there's not a singular you, there's competing things inside of you. You know, the right. flesh and the spirit is the terminology Paul gives to it in the New Testament. Which one is truer? Which one's on top? Yeah. Which one is going to speak for you inside of the room?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so that puts me in terms of Catholic theology, right? The idea of purgatory, right? Where essentially purgatory is burning out that flesh part yes. of you, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
I found it interesting that the writer chooses to help the professor when the stalker wants to stop him from planting the bomb.
Yeah. And
it's always two versus one. In the movie, they're never all three united. Somebody's mad right. at the other two.
The most canonical thing was when he threw something at the writer, right?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. yeah.
and told him, hey, this isn't a place for a stroll.
yeah. Oh, right.
yeah. Cause that's straight out of the book. So.
Well, and they did not employ stunt people. I was deeply impressed that the actor drove that Jeep onto the train tracks, did not flip it, did not drive it out of scene, and then got it righted, you know, straddling
He was skidding it for a bit there.
Oh, yes, he was. Yeah. But then that scene where he throws the pipe, I'm wondering, do they film that so that he's throwing it like 30 or 45 degrees, and because of the camera angle, it looks like it's in his direction, and he ducks to avoid it, and...
Oh, maybe.
Yeah.
Oh, that'd be fun. Good point.
You know, knowing what I know about Tarkovsky, cast safety would not have been at the top of the list.
Well, if they're wading Touché. Through chemical-infested waters to the point where it might have killed him, right. his wife, who was one of the assistant directors,
yep.
and his favorite actor, who was in Mirror and in Stalker, I think. Hmm.
And Andrei Rublev and Solaris is actually in all but the first Russian movie.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
Not a big concern with safety.
No. OSHA would not have approved of the production of Tarkovsky or Tarkovsky movies.
Yeah. So, Ben, what do you make of I mentioned that, we're sitting on James's couch and, you know, like, mm-hmm. we're like, we should do this podcast laying down. Yeah. Cause like 3/4 of the movie is people laying on the ground.
Yes.
What do you make of that?
It's an interesting moment in the film where what I was alluding or calling the sleepover slumber party earlier, where they just kind of stop and the movie just kind of stops. It is in some ways the central point of the movie. It's like we've had pretty solid forward progress, not literally forward because we're going round and round and round, but forward-ish progress up until that point. And then when they emerge and Professor has his rucksack back and realizes, wait a second, something's gone wrong. We shouldn't have survived that. Like there has to be this moment of contemplation. Mm. What the moment itself means, I don't know. I'd have to think about the whole sequence. I know a lot of the pieces, like that's where we get the Emmaus Road piece. It's where we get the dog that enters. And I love the symbol of the dog. I'd hesitate to assign a definite meaning to the symbol. You know, my religious side wants to say it's the Holy Spirit or something like that. But I would hate for that to be the only way that you can go down, you know, that interpretive road. It's definitely a presence of the zone that seems to be protective in some ways, but that's where the dog really starts to come into it. I'm always fascinated by the presence of water in Tarkovsky movies, and he's talked about that himself, that water is water, fire, and animals are kind of the three big symbols for him. We don't get a lot of fire in this movie, though we do get it at the beginning of that sequence. That's where Professor has his little cookout. But we get tons of water, like there's plenty of water in here. Mm-hmm.
Even the dry parts are watery.
Exactly. It's raining in the room later on, you know, which I, in terms of how I interpret Tarkovsky, I always have to think baptism in that case. So yeah, that's not really coherent thoughts, but this is also how interpreting Tarkovsky goes in some ways, is that it's throwing out ideas and seeing what sticks and seeing what's meaningful, and every time you go back, you're going to see more things in a sequence like that.
Well, and that's not the only scene where people are lying down, right? The wife throws the hissy fit at the beginning and ends up writhing on the floor. When Stalker gets back from the zone, he lies down on the floor in the living room, right? And then she takes him back to put him to bed. But it just seems like people's go-to rest is like lying face down in the mud.
Yeah.
Yes. I love the ending when they get back. Part of it is Tarkovsky was trying to do the concept of Aristotelian unity in this as a dramatic concept, in this being one event that takes place over a single day in a single location. Mm-hmm. He didn't quite pull off the single location, but
right.
He's playing with that dramatic concept. So the movie begins with them getting up in the morning and ends with going to bed. But I love her monologue at the end. That's a highlight of the movie for me. Well, once he's gone to sleep, it's really, really profound. You know, when she gets into that, if there wasn't suffering in the world would be a better place. Like that's a hefty claim to make. And that's a hard one. You made reference to the Book of Job earlier, and I've been fascinated by Job for years. Like, and that's part of, you know, where it's like, we're going to ask God, why is there suffering in the world? And God's like, no, you're not, but it's okay. And that's the only answer you get, you know? And so it's a deeply dissatisfying, but also very profound answer to the problem of evil that she gives there.
Mm-hmm. A common theme in previous stuff we've done. You mentioned it, Seth, with the Wrinkle in Time.
Yeah, yeah, Kamazots, right? Where everything is controlled. Everybody is happy because they have no choices.
Yeah. Well, happy.
Right. And you know, you can draw a line in that to communism, right? And you could definitely see that as in Stalker, even if it's not necessarily intended. But yeah, to what extent can people be happy if they have no choices?
Right.
Was there any other insights about Stalker that you wanted to share with us, Ben?
You know, the one other fun one I'll throw out here, just and you can play with this as much as you want to. The film is structured eerily similar to Wizard of Oz. Very, very similar.
Yeah, it starts off in black and white, and then they go into Oz in color, and then come out with you know, and we don't see the process of them coming out. We see her waking up, right? But different interpretations to what that means. It's very different in the book, but hey, that's what we should do. We should do The Wonderful Wizard of Oz.
Okay. There you go. You know, right down to the Emerald City being the place to get your wishes granted and all of that. Yeah, it's I have not read anything that tells me that was or wasn't intentional, but the parallels are very strong. That's kind of a fun, you know, if you need a lighter take on Stalker, that would be the way to go.
So I have to admit, Ben, one of the things that I like about you and the way you approach film and art and that kind of stuff is you're very comfortable saying, I don't know. After I watched Stalker, I was like, I know that Matt and Ben have talked about this. And so I looked up one of your most recent episodes, and it wasn't a super long one. And Matt asked you about something, and you're like, I don't know, you know, and yet, you know, it's still a hugely influential and important movie to you. And I like that.
Yeah. I mean, it goes to the whole way, and this again intersects with how I think about being Catholic too, is that it goes to the whole way of like thinking about the transcendent. If the transcendent be a god or art or whatever name you want to put to that, is by definition that which is beyond our ability as humans to comprehend. And so one of the things I believe is that great art is actually getting in contact with transcendent ideas. Define that how you will, as spiritually or non-spiritually or anywhere in between as you will. It's getting in contact with something that is beyond our ability to understand as humans. So the great artist is a prophet in some respects. So this is Moses coming down from the mountain, and his face is shining. And obviously I'm not trying to compare Tarkovsky with, you know, a religious experience like that, but it's a similar, like they're of a similar type in that if you feel like you can look at a movie like Stalker and say, I know what it all means, I'm going to call nonsense on that and say, no, you don't.
Right.
No, you do not. Like you're lying, maybe to yourself. Like you might be able to put the plot together. Like 2001, I can tell you what happens in the plot, but I can't tell you what it all means. Mm. So there should be like this constant with great art, constantly bumping up against this thing of, I don't know. I don't know. Well, maybe I'll see farther next time. you know, that's part of what I love about it. Like, it's that ambiguity of it's what draws me to watch movies like this.
Nice. And because of that ambiguity, every person is going to bring their own personal beliefs and
they're going to bring invasions. They're going to bring their own something to it.
Yeah,
and it leaves it open to your interpretation, which in return kind of tells you more about yourself when you start communicating that interpretation, I think.
Exactly.
That's what I'm getting from you, Ben.
Yeah, 100%. It's like, and you can debate interpretations. Like, there's good interpretation and there's bad interpretation. So it's not as though it's an anything goes proposition, but it is to say that you're going to see things in a movie like this that I'm not, and vice versa.
And that's okay.
So exactly. It's not only okay, it's essential. It's like, that's if we are encountering something that's beyond my ability to hold inside my head as a finite human being, then the only way I'm going to see more to a certain extent is A, to keep exposing myself to it, but then B, to enter into conversation with other people and see what they see. Because that's where the growth comes from. And then it's like, well, I don't agree with your interpretation. It's not quite that. And so we bump them against each other. And now there's like, assuming it's in good faith and it's not, you know, I'm going to tell you why I'm right and you're wrong, but I'm going to tell you why I think maybe you're off base here. And you say, okay, but then you're off base here. If we push against that, that's where the truly profound artistic experience comes in. And it's what I absolutely love about movies like this.
Yeah, I mean, in that sense, a movie like this requires more of the viewer, right?
Because
if you don't want to do that work, this is not the kind of movie that you really want to be watching.
No, no. This is not everything's going to be handed to you on a platter.
Yeah. And it's definitely not something that I always want from a movie.
Yeah, and I think that's fair. It's like, and probably it's mentally exhausting. Like, you do need different films of different paces and different, you know, you mentioned, like, you thought about Stalker for weeks. Well, that's only possible because you weren't watching something Stalker-esque every single day that just pushes it out of your head.
Yeah. You know, it just occurred to me it's occurred to me a couple times while reading the book that it reminded me of Annihilation by Jeff Vandermeer.
Yeah, very much so.
And the movie, in terms of the style of adaptation, it's kind of similar to from that book to the movie, where it's like the Alex Garland adaptation of Annihilation. It's just like, I'm going to adapt what it felt like to read the book, not the plot of the book. And that's a really interesting way to do it, but not necessarily what your Collins want to see.
No, they're definitely found. I would love to see someone do a completely canonical adaptation of Roadside Picnic, but I think there's room for this other one too.
Yeah. Anything else to talk about?
I think we ought to rank them.
Yeah.
Should we, though? I feel like Ben's been saying, don't rank them.
I mean, they're radically different, but I mean, obviously, you know where my ranking's going to go. Stalker's on top. Yeah. And the novel is good, but not one of the greatest things I've ever read.
Nice. Colin?
I'm going to go the inverse, and that's not going to be a surprise. Although I'm not going to say that there's the huge gap that I would have talked about in the past between the book and the movie. So I like the book better. It's more concrete. I feel like I can appreciate the movie better than I could in the past. Maybe after several years, they'll be even closer, or maybe the movie would be better than the book.
There's elements to it, I feel like, where, like, you reacted kind of strongly to the Stalker character in the book, where in the movie, you don't really see any of the negative sides of his personality. Other than, you know, he's not listening to his wife and he's going into the into the zone, but you can understand why, because he feels like we're not even in the real world here.
Yes.
Yeah, although he did steal her watch.
True.
And every time he goes in there, he risks abandoning his wife and child.
Yeah.
So I think those are nods back to the original character from the book. You know, the Stalker is not a hero, even in this sense, I don't think.
All right, how about you, James?
I'm going to go video game, book, movie.
There we go. I have a tough time with this one just because I do feel like the movie has grown on me a lot. And I did enjoy the book, but the parts that I enjoyed in the book are to me done more profoundly in the movie. We're talking about that moment of making the decision about, do I go in? And that's that was the part that stuck out to me on the first watch, and then in reading the book even more. So I'm going to go movie book.
All right, I swayed one of you. Well, no, but I, in all seriousness, it's less about the ranking. I think that what I have gotten from you guys is, like, even if Tarkovsky isn't necessarily, you're going to jump at him the way I do, I don't think you guys are completely averse to more Tarkovsky in your future. You know, Solaris is still lurking out there.
Yeah.
I do like the idea of doing Solaris, since we talked about it in relation to this movie.
Yeah.
So that'd be kind of cool to do some point.
And the Soderbergh adaptation's good too. It's very different than the Tarkovsky one, but I like all three versions of Solaris quite a bit.
And I will say, this conversation makes me want to go watch 2001 again.
Oh, now that's mission accomplished.
100%. Yeah.
I don't care how you ranked it. Like, that's a win.
Nice. All right, Ben, how can people find you if they want to?
TheSciFiChristian.com. We do also have a Patreon, patreon.com/TheSciFiChristian, where you get a little bit more. We have an uncensored feed over there.
Where Matt doesn't have to bleep you.
Exactly.
Actually, you pretty much just save stuff for that.
Yeah, we do. Actually, the thing we do in our Patreon that's really a lot of fun is we do what we call deep dives. We're going through the Odyssey right now. We just went through the Iliad. So if you want to off some classic literature and catch up on that, go through them book by book, that's the place to do it.
There are some pretty good graphic novels for both of those.
I mean, you can give that a shot too.
Nice. All right. I'll get us out of here with the blessing. So thanks, Ben, for being here. It was a lot of fun. We'll do it again in eight years, you know?
Yes.
You'll have 15 kids by then.
Yeah. Good God.
You've already had to upgrade to like the short bus, right? So,
that thing was such a nightmare that we have since sold it and gotten rid of it. That's a whole other story, but good Lord, that was a nightmare of 2 years of ownership.
Nice. All right. Thank you everybody for listening. And until next time, may the road rise up to meet you, and may the book always fall open to where you left off.